If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Going for your first ever run around the park. Literally running errands all over town. Running for the finish line and your personal best. If you run, you're a runner. Find the shoes and clothes to run your way at newbalance.com/running. New Balance. Run your way.
Today, healthier is happening at CVS Health in more ways than you've ever seen. It's wellness destinations for seniors, including select locations with Oak Street Health and CVS Pharmacy. It's doctors, nurses, pharmacists, and everyone in between, offering quality care and support virtually, in person, and on the phone. It's in-home evaluations through Signify Health and meeting mental health needs through Aetna. And those are just a few of the ways healthier is happening. To see more, visit cvshealth.com/healthierhappenstogether. CVS Pharmacy, Oak Street Health, CVS Specialty, Signify Health, and Aetna are part of CVS Health. Eligibility and services vary by location and individual.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
From a distance, we can look at the geopolitics and regional politics of the Second World War and say, well, of course, they wanted to fight against this great evil, but they're human beings, so they cared about what human beings care about, love. They're sad if they missed people. So, you know, the letters they received from home, and it's interesting reading what doctors at the time say about it, what the censors say about it, these things really, really matter. Often, way more than what's going on the battlefield.
That was Jonathan Fennell talking about the morale of the British Army during the Second World War.
You're listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. For today's episode, we've spoken to Jonathan Fennell, who's Senior Lecturer in Defence Studies at King's College London. His latest book explores the stories of British and Commonwealth soldiers during the Second World War, and this was the subject of his conversation with our Deputy Digital Editor, Eleanor Evans, when they met up recently at the Shrivenham Defence Academy.
So today we're talking about your book called Fighting the People's War, The British and Commonwealth Armies in the Second World War. First of all, I wonder if we could start by talking about the notion of People's War, as you mean it in this context.
The Second World War holds quite a special place in British history, doesn't it? I think people look at it with a great sense of pride. Britain stood against the greatest tyranny ever faced. The argument goes it did so alone for an awful long time, and as such saved the Western world in this moment of profound crisis. And so the war is often looked at through a rosy lens. It is a good war. It is a war where the people came together and in a united fashion fought with great energy. And the reward that they received as a consequence was a better life through welfare state and NHS, and some sort of a safety net for those who were less fortunate than others. So the narrative is a very positive one. The war was a good war, fought by a brave and united people, and we saved the world.
And do you think that's a narrative that has is still in place kind of across the Commonwealth nations, or how do you think it differs?
Well, it certainly holds strong in what we used to refer to as the dominions, such as Australia, South Africa, New Zealand, Canada. I think much less so in India, which saw the war in a very different light. And really the big narrative in Indian history is about independence and nationalism. And the war often doesn't get much attention at all in Indian history and historiography. So I think certainly in the kind of the white dominions, the war is very much seen as a good war, as a people's war.
So with this book then, why did you choose to look at the history of the Second World War in this way across the Commonwealth nations rather than kind of the national histories that exist?
Fear of failure. I was very lucky. Cambridge asked me to write the book. And there are some super books on the British Army, on the Australian Army, South Africa, you get the idea. And I didn't feel that there was a huge amount of space to better some of the existing literature. But I thought, let's look at it as a team and how ideas moved across the Commonwealth during war and whether the experience was similar or dissimilar. And that just opened up a huge array of options. And access to a huge array of sources that hadn't been seen before. For whatever reason, in the British archives, a lot of stuff got destroyed. I don't know why, but destroyed it was. But the Canadians and the New Zealanders and the South Africans, they kept everything. So you can get access to these wonderful documents as relevant to the British experience as elsewhere by traveling the world. So I had great fun seeing the Commonwealth. Getting stuck into some archives and finding some wonderful documents. And let's face it, the armies were designed to fight as a team. And really, we ought to study them in that way. And when we do, we start to see a much more complex and, I think, hopefully interesting history.
Well, if we could talk about the formation of the Commonwealth armies then, because you just said they were kind of designed to fight as a team, but I think in your book that shows it wasn't always the case and that definitely changed. So what can you tell us about the Commonwealth Army structure at the start and then how it kind of changed as the conflict progressed?
Sure. There's a wonderful new book, I'll have to just mention it, by Douglas Delaney called The Imperial Army Project. And his book outlines that that development. So I really would recommend it to any readers or listeners to have a look at it. But broadly speaking, from the beginning of the 20th century, there was, I guess, a recognition that imperial defence required everybody to play a role. And there was a development of shared ideas through letters, but also doctrine. So basically the military writes down simple processes that it can share to avoid having to learn anew every time it faces a problem. So the Commonwealth armies developed a very similar set of understandings and processes to guide its fighting. And it developed a very similar set of technologies and weapons so that everybody was used to trying to deal with the same kit. So there was just a general recognition that the British peoples of the world would fight together and that if that was going to happen, there was an attempt made to coordinate and to ensure that they did so effectively.
Can we talk about the mobilisation of these forces? Because various countries introduced conscription or they had various challenges to address within their own nations.
This was, for me, was one of the more fascinating parts of the book. Again, I think the kind of the simple narrative of a people's war suggests that everybody went willingly to war. We jump back to 1914, this great excitement, we're fighting against the greatest evil that's ever existed, and the British peoples came together with great heart and determination. But when you start to look at the figures, and there's quite a lot of number crunching in the book, if you're interested in numbers, there's plenty of it. We see that people with a very strong relationship with Great Britain and people who had perhaps experienced a more benign 1930s, 1920s, were more inclined to fight. So the state of the home front translated into the extent of mobilization. So to put it, I guess, in a straightforward way, English-speaking Canadians were more likely to join up than French-speaking Canadians because English-speaking Canadians had a very strong relationship with the mother country. The same goes for English-speaking South Africans, you get the idea, rather than Afrikaners. What we then find also is that a lot of people had a really rough 1930s, right? I mean, there was the Depression, there was the memory of the First World War, And people weren't too keen to go through that experience again, unless there was something, you know, really clearly that was going to benefit them if they did. So what I found was, anyway, that there was real problems actually mobilising the armies. And in some cases, the British and Commonwealth nations had to resort to conscription to get numbers through the doors.
So if we take that notion of a people's war, if you have soldiers then without kind of that clear ideology, that clear kind of belief, or they're, you know, not as driven as we would have been led to believe by previous accounts, how did that affect the early years of the conflict, 1940-42?
So, I mean, Germany mobilises for war really much earlier than British and Commonwealth countries. And so when it comes to this major conflagration in 1940, you have a well-trained German armed forces with some very impressive kit, and they're coming up against a much less well-trained British and Commonwealth set of armies with, you know, not poor equipment, but perhaps not at the most sophisticated, and an army that is questioning what the whole thing's about. Churchill as yet has not articulated a great vision for a post-war world that will benefit the ordinary soldier. So the result is fairly lackadaisical performance. Again and again, from France to Crete to Greece to North Africa to Singapore, there's this really consistent narrative that comes out of operational reports, commanders' reports. Our boys won't stick it. You know, Churchill's pulling his hair out at home. Why won't our boys fight in the way that they did in the First World War? And so this, I mean, it's not entirely an issue of morale. It's very much also an issue of training. If you're not prepared, it's hard to do really sophisticated things on a battlefield. But there's no doubt that there's kind of a hope that in spite of other limitations, the sheer gutsiness of the British race of peace bulls and its associated imperial manpower, whatever, will fight it out and make a difference. It doesn't happen. And Churchill is fairly upset by the whole experience. So there's really a requirement to fundamentally change everything. How are we going to win with a poorly trained army that doesn't seem to be very highly motivated? And so you get, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the man. I know Montgomery is a divisive character. I'm certainly no Montgomery apologist. I can see many of his weaknesses. But what he does do in 1942, when he rocks up in the North African desert, this moment of crisis at Eighth Army, is he identifies the character of the problem he's faced with, and he gets it clear. And so he decides, well, we can't do really sophisticated things with a poorly trained, undermotivated armed forces or army. So he reins it in. So British kind of doctrine, the way the British Army thinks about fighting, was very dynamic and mobile in the early years of the war. He says, we can't do that anymore. We have to rein it in. We're going to fight in a very structured, systematic manner. We're going to use the vast amounts of artillery we now have available by 1942, and we're going to blast the lights out of the enemy. And broadly speaking, you know, that works at Allenhain. If you can picture it at Allenhain, you know, October, November 1942, before Allenhain, there was no victory, only defeats after there was only victories kind of stuff. The problem with this new combat technique, although it worked in the specific context of El Alamein, where there was very little room for maneuver, when you get into the space of the desert further west, or when the Allies advanced into Sicily, where there was very mountainous terrain, or they advanced into Italy, where they faced the same problems, artillery couldn't dominate the battlefield in the same way. So there was a requirement to kind of return to the much more sophisticated tactical approaches of the early years. Infiltration, rapid movement. But the British Army still has a fairly lackadaisically motivated army and a fairly poorly trained army. And so really the second half of the war becomes this process of improving training over time, where possible addressing the soldiers' concerns about the meaning of the war through army education, which we've already talked about. And by 1944, 1945, it's starting to pay dividends. And we might get into some of the more detail on that, but you've just, certainly in the West, right, you all of a sudden have a military instrument that is more impressive and can actually have some serious decisive victories.
What are, the moments, the victories that kind of prove that?
Sure. Well, they're all kind of, I mean, they're all kind of post-Normandy in the West, okay? I mean, I know most of the literature, or an awful lot of the literature focuses on Normandy. It's still arguably a period of the war where the British Army really matters, where the Americans haven't completely taken over in terms of numbers and command, and you know, the Russians are still relatively far away in the East. But it's really only on the kind of march into Germany in terms of what's going on in Northwest Europe where the British and Commonwealth armies really start to pull it together. So after Normandy, Montgomery starts to get a little bit frustrated. So, you know, post-Alamein, he's reined it all in, developed what some scholars refer to as this colossal cracks methodology, which is, you know, you blast the living daylights out of your enemy. But it doesn't produce the outcomes he expects. Britain needs to win the war quickly on the winning and be seen to win, be major player in winning that war. Britain is, you know, going hugely into debt as a consequence of every day that passes. But colossal cracks will not provide that. So Montgomery, after Normandy, he has a moment where he engages again with this military term doctrine, with the way the army is supposed to fight. And he returns it in many ways to interwar, early war understandings. We must devolve command and control, i.e. let local people decide what to do, trust them. And we must return mobility, speed, maneuver, aggression to the battlefield, which is now possible because you have a highly trained and much better motivated armed army. And so it's quite a, you know, it's quite a gutsy thing, right, to change a winning team. And so he changed a losing team in, you know, the end of 1942 with positive results. He'd realized over time that that system no longer worked. And he changed it again. And so really on the kind of the final march into Germany, the crossing of the Rhine and kind of the mobile warfare as they advanced into Germany in 1945, you see a much more dynamic British army. And you see a very similar story in Italy, where in the final months of the war, the British and Commonwealth armies fight with mobility, aggression, no little professionalism. So there's a turnaround, and I think an impressive one. I think the army, in the end, comes out okay from the story.
You just mentioned there that Britain had to be seen to be winning the war and not be beholden to America. Mm. And how important was that notion of Britain winning the war important in propping up empire, and how much did that succeed or fail?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it, that Churchill says he didn't become the King's first minister to preside over the dissolution of the British Empire. And indeed, that is exactly what happened. I mean, the key example that's usually given is the disaster at Singapore. So a British and Commonwealth army that outnumbers its enemy, the Japanese Imperial Army, is soundly beaten and doesn't fight with the type of, I suppose, determination that you might associate with the Russian army in this period of the war, with what the Americans were doing at Luzon, what, even what the Australians had, say, done at Tobruk and places like that. And it was, I mean, the language used at the time, so not kind of an embarrassment, and the worst defeat the British Empire ever faced, some have argued. And this, I mean, when you think about it, there was never, you know, lots of British soldiers policing the empire. It was always a small force that relied on local knowledge and perhaps a perception of power more so than real power. And when that perception of power was, you know, cut away from the knee, the logic of empire really fell apart quite quickly. So the defeat of the British and Commonwealth armies in the Far East, and I'm not the first to make this argument by any means, was a nail in the coffin of the empire. But that the game wasn't over as such. You know, a quick turnaround and all might be forgiven, and the empire might yet live to fight another day. But the problem with the colossal cracks approach, as necessary as it was in North Africa at the end of 1942, it just doesn't produce fast results. It's an attritional way of fighting. And to right the wrongs, if that's the way you want to put it, of 1942, there has to be a quick turnaround, and Britain can't do it like this. So the inability to quickly defeat the Germans in North Africa and Sicily and Italy, and in the same fashion quickly turn things around in the jungles in the Far East, means that the war drags on and drags on and drags on. And Britain's central place in 1940 becomes a supporting act by 1945. And it's the Americans and the Russians who largely win the war. And so whereas it was a a British piece in 1918. In 1815, in 1945, it's an American and Russian piece. And Britain's place in the war, Britain's place in the world is fundamentally undermined.
And even once soldiers were at war, they were involved in the combat, you found some really interesting things by looking at censorship summaries, which looks at, well, it allowed you to look at the morale of soldiers and their politicisation as well. What can you tell us about those sources?
Sure. I mean, it's every historian's dream, right, to find a set of sources that no one's really looked at. And it's even better when there's just loads of them. So I found 925 of these censorship reports or summaries. And they're typically reports of about 20 pages long that are summarizing what soldiers are writing home about. And the 925 that I have are based, I think, on about 17 million letters. So we're getting this really representative sample of opinion and motivations and feelings throughout the war. And in many ways, I think that there's good a resource as, say, Gallup polls, you know, public opinion surveys in Britain during the war. And so this big cohort, this, you know, significant cohort of young men, mostly, who are fighting in the war, we can get an idea what they're thinking, how they're feeling, how they're experiencing the war. And it's quite radical, much to my amazement. You know, I think the automatic assumption is that militaries are right-wing and conservative. Well, the exact opposite seems to come out of this, that they're dying to talk about politics for a start. So the apolitical British soldier that we often hear about in the literature doesn't appear to be a reality. Soldiers are talking about politics. They care about politics. They care about the world that's going to emerge post-war. And so they're crying out for something. And we might talk about this in due course. They don't necessarily get what they want. And that causes problems with morale.
I wonder if we could talk about the process of censorship, because I think it's just really interesting to know what that process was, how these letters were kind of read and processed. And then how, if we can talk typically about it, how did the typical soldier feel about the process of censorship?
I think he hated it most of the time and felt that he was he's having his personal world violated in some way. But I think there was also recognition that security mattered. I mean, if you're giving away secrets, it would cost lives. So there was this kind of dynamic, I suppose, at times it was deeply resented, at other times it was recognized as a military necessity. So let's say you're a young fella, you're 20 years of age, and you want to write to your wife or your girlfriend back home. You write your letter. Some of them are censored by your commanding officer, which is tough to take because then he knows what's going on. But each soldier had a certain number of letters that could be censored centrally at the base where nobody knew his name. So these censorship summaries were largely constructed by base censors who were looking at a vast number of letters, and then they were summarizing what was said and sending what they found off to unit commanders to say, oh, listen, there's a problem in your unit, there's too few cigarettes, or sending it off to welfare amenity groups to try and address certain issues, or they were sending these reports back to commands in Delhi, in London, in Australia, New Zealand. So they're really quite useful sources for the military, and thankfully also useful sources for the historian who's trying to recreate the experience of the ordinary citizen soldier in a world war.
Mm-hmm. And so if previous historical records have looked at kind of the top down, you know, if you've got records of Churchill, you know what the generals were up to and all of the rest of it, just how significant is this kind of the censorship summary that gives us a newer view of the civvies in the army?
I think it's not surprising. I'll argue it's very significant, right? I mean, you look at what's going on around us today, ordinary people matter. And when you think about, you know, big ideas such as strategy, how states survive, we usually look at the past and the present through the lens of the great men and women, those who seem to have the power to construct and drive our universe. But I'm often shocked, I mean, probably you are too, when you look at politics today, how little control the great men and women really have over what happens. You know, real people have agency. So, you know, you talk to the modern military about strategic privates or strategic corporals, the decision of one man or woman close to the enemy can have strategic effect.
A point that I found really interesting in your book was the idea that the social history and the military history, they were very much codependent. So, for instance, a fracture maybe in the home front or the politics of the home front affecting morale of the men at war. So do you think that they're very codependent?
It kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Like, a young man is thinking about his people back home, his family, his loved ones. You know, I think from a distance, we can look at the geopolitics and regional politics of the Second World War and say, well, of course, they wanted to fight against this great evil. But they're human beings. So they cared about what human beings care about, love. They were sad if they missed people. So, you know, the letters they received from home, and it's interesting reading what doctors at the time say about it, what the censors say about it. These things really, really mattered. Often, way more than what's going on the battlefield. That's other people's business, right? That's the great men's business to ensure that the battles are won to a degree. The thing I care about as a young soldier, am I going to see my wife again sometime soon? Are my kids okay? Do my mum and dad have enough food to eat? Of course, that's the human experience. So the battlefront is intimately connected with the home front. So what happens on the home front can have really profound implications for winning and losing. And that story becomes, I suppose, discoverable by virtue of the censorship summaries, because we can see they cared, and then we can see these fluctuations in morale, that there's problems at the same time as the problems on the home front. And I mean, so stuff I talked about in my first book on morale in the desert. So, you know, there's problems with South African morale, say, when things are going wrong in North Africa in 1942. And the censors are really quite attuned to this. And so they write a whole series of kind of special reports saying, you know, what's going wrong with our guys in the desert? And they quote these letters from wives and sweethearts to the front. And the wives and sweethearts are having a really hard time. All things are not rosy on the South African home front. Those families that are without their breadwinners are struggling for food. And this is passed on to the soldiers of the front, who feel that they've been let down very significantly by the home front and by the government. You have examples where, you know, a wife is writing to her husband saying, you know, shoot yourself in the foot. I mean, find a way to get out, basically. Surrender if you have to. I need you to come back to me alive. And the South African censors are saying, A, how could this not affect the morale of our soldiers at the front? And B, actually, it is affecting the morale of our soldiers at the front. And this has implications for combat performance. And, you know, the disasters in the desert in 1942 were caused by many, many reasons, some tactical problems, some technical problems, even leadership problems. But of those factors, I think we have to look at morale. And when we look at morale, we have to look at what's going on the home front and how that fed through to the soldiers on the battlefront.
We don't always realise just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
So you already mentioned, you know, these kind of censorship summaries might affect maybe supply lines or decisions might be maybe taken. How did decision makers use these summaries to inform strategy, to inform other kind of key decision making? Or were they used that way?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose they're certainly used very much on a local level. So I can give you an example in the middle of the Normandy campaign. A lot of stuff written on British Army in Normandy. There's a sense kind of mid-July that the troops are utterly exhausted. And this comes through in censorship reports. And so very quickly, senior commanders start to get welfare amenities to the continent. So 1 week you have a letter saying, no one's had a shower in weeks, no one's had, we're running out of cigarettes, no one has clean clothes. And then the following, and morale is terrible. And then the following week, you see they have all these things and morale has bounced back. So you do see this kind of this dynamic interaction between command and the ordinary soldier when the censorship summaries report that things are problematic. Almost always, about a week later or 2 weeks later, you see that problem has been fixed in that unit. So there's no doubt. Take Normandy as an example again. That one of the things that they really tried to stress at the start of the Normandy campaign was to bring censors over with the initial landings, because the commanders wanted to know what the troops were experiencing, and they recognised that morale mattered. So how do you assess morale? Well, get the censors in their early doors. And on previous expeditionary operations, they hadn't done that and had felt that they'd kind of let things slip a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that kind of stuff, you know. Montgomery, Slim, you know, Wavell, these famous names, these great commanders, if you read their theory, their memoirs, they all say morale is everything. And they use the censorship summaries as a tool to help understand that, mm-hmm. that dynamic.
Were they ever used as a political tool, or were they ever used kind of by political figures in any way?
It's a very good question. I'm sure that some of the reports did get in front of politicians, but nothing jumped into my mind. But it is interesting how political the things are. I mean, the aspect of, the military experience in the Second World War that was kind of most politicized or garnered most political attention was army education. So midway through the war, Ronald Adam, you probably never heard of Ronald Adam, right? Astonishing man. He was the adjutant general of the British Army, which effectively means he was kind of in charge of HR. He looked after the welfare, helped oversee selection. So he was kind of looking after the morale of the troops. And he recognizes, along with many other senior officers, that there's this kind of ideological vacuum. The soldiers don't know what they're fighting for. So he says, well, we've got to do something about this. So Cromwell said, give me a soldier who knows what he fights and knows what he knows. So if we have a if we have an army without ideological conviction, how are we supposed to win against the Germans, who are, you know, very ideologically driven? So he brings in army education, which kind of preaches this idea of a new Jerusalem, a new Britain. Fight for Britain now, and by gum, you'll get something in return once victory is achieved. But the Conservatives are a little bit nervous about this, understandably, if you understand Conservative politics, making promises with money we don't know that we'll actually have. And so there's a concerted effort by Churchill and others to destroy army education. And Adam and others are quite adept at avoiding that from happening. And army education, I think the censorship summary show quite clearly, was appreciated by the troops. Army education played a very, I think, important role in helping the troops kind of articulate their political, kind of the emergence of political thought that happened as a consequence of their combat experience. So it teaches them the language and the mechanisms available to them to affect social change. So it plays a very important role, I think. And in many ways, it did become politicized.
I wondered if there were any, what are the other examples of other countries within the Commonwealth, of their messaging? What was their kind of ideological impetus, I guess, for the war?
Well, I mean, apart from the idea of kind of the British peoples stand together, that New Zealand, New Zealand's security, Australia's security was dependent upon the Royal Navy and Britain's Britain's power. So, I mean, there's that kind of standard narrative of codependence, which in many ways actually gets destroyed as a consequence of the war, right? Because it becomes quite evident to Australia and New Zealand by 1942 that Britain can't protect the Antipodes. And what do they need? Well, they need a new protector, and that becomes the United States. And we get the United States being the dominant power in the second half of the 20th century. But in terms of politicization, what is interesting, I mean, I managed to find voting statistics. So soldiers who are expected to fight for democracy get a chance to partake in it during the war as well. So in 1940, 1943, you have elections in Australia. In 1943, you have elections in New Zealand and South Africa. In 1945, you have elections in Canada and, as we well know, in the United Kingdom. And the dynamic seems to hold true across all these cases, that the closer to danger, I say combat, but danger will do, that these soldiers are during the war, the more left-leaning their vote tends to be. So New Zealand airmen taking great risks with their life over the skies of Europe in 1943 are more likely to vote for the New Zealand Labour Party than a New Zealander training in Canada to fly a plane, or a New Zealander training back home in New Zealand to learn how to fight. So it's quite consistent. And I guess it does appear to be a very consistent set of experiences across the Commonwealth. It just maybe varies in terms of intensity or some little stories here and there.
And did you find that particularly surprising?
I suppose in a way, because so much of the history has become about national histories and it becomes siloed in these national histories, and we are consumed by our own uniqueness. And Britain has kind of developed an identity separate from the Commonwealth and Empire today that perhaps wasn't the case in the 1940s.
What are the events or kind of national story, national history that you think kind of cemented that idea of Britain as the plucky kind of plucky?
Sure, yeah. I mean, the alone narrative, right, in 1940, standing against the White Cliffs of Dover, fist in the air, sure. Take us if you can, Britain against the world. I mean, the experience of the Blitz, which was undoubtedly utterly appalling. And the image of the Blitz has been a uniquely British experience when it comes to kind of the Western Allies, I suppose. Has created this image of a very unique experience that Britain went through. I mean, Australia, you know, doesn't really get the same treatment. New Zealand, South Africa, Canada. Although India was invaded, it was in the eastern provinces. So I think in part, yes, the experience itself drives the way we talk about it now.
You said that many of these political beliefs kind of emerged as a result of their experiences on the front line. So how did we see those materialise in post-war nations and societies?
Sure. I mean, in different ways, right? Yeah. So the closer to combat, the closer to danger, the more left-leaning the vote appears to be. And so why is that? I mean, the best kind of theory I can come up with to try and explain it is soldiers became deeply aware of how interconnected they all were. If you're lying in a slit trench, you become aware that the individual building the weapons in Birmingham is of vital importance to your welfare, that the individual 20 metres away in another slit trench is vital importance to your welfare. So the kind of narrative of, you know, individualism becomes problematic. It becomes very obvious that you rely on others for your future and your well-being. So those political parties that were best able to, I guess, build a narrative that reflected that experience were more likely to garner soldiers' vote. This was very powerfully experienced in 1945, where the Labour manifesto articulated a vision of a more equal, egalitarian, fairer society. You know, these keywords, fairness, come through again and again in the censorship summaries. And they were better able to tap into this kind of political moment that the soldiers were experiencing. And so it happened, you know, depending on your political perspectives, in a fairly positive way in the United Kingdom. Labour get in, and indeed the welfare state that the soldier dreams about becomes a reality, or close enough. In South Africa, it's a very different dynamic. The argument about fairness and egalitarianism becomes one that's shared between white South Africans. So the Afrikaner and the English-speaking South African fight together on the front line. They recognize that their future is interconnected. But to achieve this interconnected, fairer world, there's a fairly shocking added thing necessary, which is we have to exclude other members of society, Black South Africans. And so the experience of the front line creates a toxic political dynamic, which, as far as the evidence suggests, influenced the way South African veterans voted in the apartheid election in 1948.
Mm-hmm. So you write that the Indian Army, it significantly changed from what it was at the start of the war to the end. And you say that that's almost that illustrates the extent of the transformation of the entire Commonwealth forces, British Commonwealth forces. What do you mean by that?
I mean, it's extraordinary, really, what the Indian Army was able to do. It expanded, greatly, kind of tenfold in the space of a number of years. It had it was made up of, young fellas who largely had almost no time for the British Empire, who were economic recruits, i.e. there wasn't much better going on in India at the time, therefore they felt like they had to sign up. The Indian Army is almost completely incompetent. In the early years of the war, maybe taking East Africa aside, the kind of expanded Indian Army is fairly incompetent. I hope I'm not being totally unfair in saying that. And yet by 1944, certainly by 1945, the Indian Army is a phenomenal fighting tool. So, the story of transformation here is quite impressive from an institutional military history perspective, rather than or the social history. Here is an institution carrying out change at a rapid pace. So how does it do it, I guess, is an interesting story. Here we are in Shrivenham at the Defence Academy of the United Kingdom. And we talk about training all the time. We're educating senior officers here about warfare, but the way you convert ideas into meaningful practice is by practicing, by training. So the Indian Army quickly develops a new doctrine, that word again, right? A new way of fighting that it communicates throughout its vast command. And they translate this new way of fighting, which is much more dynamic than what happens in the West, because you can't do colossal cracks in the jungle. You have to devolve command and control, i.e. you have to trust the young fella in the jungle to make decisions, because you can't see 5 meters to your right or left. So it really becomes about speed and individual agency and motivation in the jungle in a way that it doesn't in the desert, right? So huge new training apparatus were put in place in India, where soldiers were put into the jungle, put through their paces, taught how to survive, taught not to fear the noises of the jungle, empowered to make decisions by themselves. And by training, they managed to refine the ideas that were articulated in doctrine, and they became a really effective fighting force. So at Imphal and Kohima, I don't know if our listeners would have heard of those battles, in the jungles of Burma, they were successful. And they kind of inflicted one of the big defeats on the Japanese army. And by 1945, after those serious successes, they advanced hundreds of miles towards Rangoon in one of the most impressive military operations in the history of warfare. So to go from almost complete incompetence in 1942 to astonishing mobile warfare by 1945 is quite the story. And I guess a story that any institution or company could read and take lessons from. How do you go from disaster? Well, it was defeat into victory. Wasn't that Slim's his book.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess it's a point worth reiterating. I know we visited it earlier, but that empowerment then in tandem with that politicisation, can we talk about that impact then in the region?
Yeah. So the ordinary Indian soldier learns how to organise and develops a sense of self-confidence. And this matters then when the Great Partition takes place. So we're years after the war now, right? India's gone from the empire, or it's about to go from the empire, and there's going to be two new states where the Indian Raj used to stand, Pakistan and India. And for that to happen, there are two kind of key parts of the country that are going to be ripped apart or split in half, the Punjab and Bengal. And especially dynamic, destructive period in the history of the subcontinent. And, you know, estimates vary in terms of how many people died during the bloodletting of this period. So there was a general desire, I think, to kind of change the arithmetic on the ground before this partition took place. And so there's a lot of violence as, you know, one side is trying to grab hold of certain places before to make it a reality on the ground so that it becomes either part of India or Pakistan. And then there's this fast movement of people from one side to the other, so that, you know, Muslims move to Pakistan and Hindus move into this new Hindustan of India. What we find is a lot of these population movements were coordinated by veterans who developed organizational skill and confidence during the war. And where there were veterans present, these vast population movements were usually done more effectively and usually at less loss of life. So whereas kind of the experience of the war had politicized, you know, Australian, New Zealand, South African, and indeed Indian troops, it also developed a certain set of skills that allowed them to play, you know, to impact the future of their countries in other ways. So the organizational skill developed by Indian soldier in many ways kind of saved lots of lives during a really traumatic and difficult period in the history of the subcontinent.
Mm-hmm. So do you think there needs to be more of a shift then in looking at individual histories or individual motivations?
I mean, I suppose it's kind of the historian's role, isn't it, to look at the past and discover its complexity and to try and explain it in some way. And when the historian does that, usually we find that kind of simple narratives just don't stack up, and that we tell a story after the fact to make it comfortable for ourselves. It's a people's war, it was a good war, and we were the good guys and we can move on and be proud. And of course, there's an element of that and there's a truth in that, but there's also a story out there about, you know, upset and horror and sadness and people not stepping up at this moment of crisis and people looking to themselves rather than to the interests of the state. It's disunity as much as unity. And I suppose that matters if you believe the ordinary person matters, if you believe that, you know, Joe Bloggs can have an effect on history. Because if you think it's all down to Monty and Churchill, which is, let's be honest, the way the story is usually told, and, you know, Churchill told the story himself, and that was the way it kind of came out, and we've bought it ever since. And, you know, Churchill was an extraordinary man, fascinating man, nobody doubts it. But my study of history suggests that it is probably that, you know, the young fella in a slit trench who decides on a Thursday at 4 o'clock, when the tanks are rolling in his direction, I'm going to stay here and fight. And that slows down the enemy and makes a difference to the commander a mile, 2 miles, 5 miles, 10 miles behind the line, who can then has time to send in the reinforcements. And that commander is then the hero, right? We all talk about this guy forever. Whereas it's the young fella in slit trench who says, who might well have died and we never hear of again, who enabled that whole thing. And so by exploring the experience of the ordinary soldier through the censorship summaries, by giving them credit, I think, where credit's due, history looks a little bit different, or even a lot different. And I hope that, you know, that story is a really positive, exciting one for every young fella and young woman in anywhere. I can make a difference. And history seems to say that you can.
That was Jonathan Fennell. Fighting the People's War, the British and Commonwealth Armies and the Second World War is out now in both the UK and the US, published by Cambridge University Press. And don't forget to visit historyextra.com for lots more Second World War history. Now, before we go, I'd like to pay tribute to our long-standing producer, Jack Fletcher, who, after 6 years at the helm of this podcast, is going to be leaving for pastures new. In the time he's been here, he's produced over 400 episodes and has been instrumental in making this into one of the world's most popular history podcasts. He'll be much missed by everyone here on the team, and we wish him all the best for his upcoming audio adventures. And that is about it for today, except to say that we'll be back, of course, on Thursday, when Nicholas Vincent will be discussing one of history's most infamous monarchs.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.